We are now calling court file A241041, Craig Stevenson et al. Appellant versus Sean Stevenson et al. Respondent. Counsel, good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. I will note that you each have 15 minutes for your initial argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. On the side of the podium, there is a button to adjust the podium up and down. I'll ask that because this matter is being recorded, before each part of your argument, if you can identify yourself for the court. With that, the appellant can begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, my name is Matthew Scott. I represent appellants Craig and Marie Stevenson. This is really a two-pronged appeal. The first is as it relates to costs and disbursements, which were entered in error by the district court, which abused its discretion. And then the second component of this is a nunk-pro-tunk order that was essentially a backdated judgment by 8 months. From my review and rereading of the briefs, the issues seem pretty clear. The contrast between the briefing is pretty stark. At this stage, the court has a few issues to parse through, but really the detail is the problem in this case. Not a problem, but it's going to take a little bit more work than some appeals that have broad issues that once decided resolve the whole appeal. What I want to do is go through and summarize, and I would say initially, Your Honors, that this is an excellent case for a published decision in the state of Minnesota. It gives this court a real opportunity to dig into a lot of the very specific nuances of awards.
What would the syllabus point be?
What's that?
What would the syllabus point be?
There would be a number of syllabus points, Your Honor, one of which would be that where a party does not come forward and carry their burden of proof as to a specific request for a cost and disbursement, that party cannot then prevail at the district court level. What you see in the objection that we filed at the district court level, and then the opposition to that, is that there are many instances where the respondents in this case were just silent on the issue or the question. And under the circumstances, there is a burden of proof that the cost has to be reasonable and necessary to the case. And in this case, you have multiple costs that were incurred that were sought by the respondents and awarded by the district court. And under the circumstances, what we found in the application for those costs is we found revelations about documents that had not been produced, witnesses that had not been disclosed. And the argument by the respondents here is, well, there's already been a substantive appeal. And therefore, this court shouldn't look closely at the affidavit or the application they filed that really reveals a lot of wrongdoing by the respondents. They sought costs for an expert report from John Carney. The expert report was necessitated by spoliation of evidence and then perjury about whether that spoliation had occurred. The gist, Your Honors, is that Sean Stevenson was deposed. Sean Stevenson lied in his deposition about whether he had deleted text messages. That lie was later admitted to, but before it was admitted to, counsel for the respondents retained Mr. Carney, and they tried to mitigate the lie, mitigate the harm, and they were only partially able to do that. Here, the district court looked at John Carney's report and essentially awarded half, or gave kind of like this half measure.
With regard to that, didn't the district court recognize the piece about the lying, but then also find that there was another purpose for the Carney forensics work, which was in relation to discovery requests made by appellants, and that was therefore some of the costs were justified, and the district court split the amount.
That was
and noted case law that permits kind of this sort of rough justice in this area.
And that's the argument that was made. That is not supported by the record. It's not supported at the district court level, and it's not supported in this appeal.
Well, the court did note that the Kearney Forensics was also their work was also in response to being inundated by defendants' response that Kearney Forensics' work was partially in response to being inundated by overburdensome discovery requests, and the district court seemed to find merit in that, and then went on to say that the court finds wisdom in the notion that the essential goal of all shifting statutes is to do rough justice, not to achieve auditing perfection. So how did the district court abuse its discretion in light of the findings and that legal standard set forth in the Fox case?
It abused its discretion, Your Honor, because the reason that John Kearney was retained is because there was spoliation and perjury. That spoliation and perjury led to a lot of discovery, inquiries into where these text messages were, whether they could be recovered, who else's phone they might be on. And so when you open that door by deleting text messages, hire an expert, and then don't expect there to be any discovery into the deleted messages. This was a conspiracy case, Your Honor. There were four defendants, three of whom routinely exchanged text messages. And when we compare which messages were deleted, we have the same series of messages that are gone. What the court did here is they said, Sean's text messages, yeah, you can get money. I won't charge you for the spoliation of those messages. But if you want to try to find those messages on Rini's phone or any other phone, then you're not going to get the costs of those. I'm still going to award those costs to the respondents. What the court did is not rough justice. It was injustice.
Court, with all due respect, I'm looking at, it's page 4 of the addendum, and it seems like this judge summarize the judge's experience with this litigation in the top paragraph of that page, where he talked about extensive discovery, extensive motion practice, court granted multiple motions seeking to limit plaintiffs, so you, from engaging in overburdensome discovery. However, the court also granted your motions for sanctions after counsel terminated a deposition unilaterally, issued an order granting spoliation of sanctions against defendant Sean Stevenson. So the judge recognizes all of that and says those sanctions arose from Sean's deletion of text messages he had sent regarding a dispute, topic of which was the subject of extensive discovery. And it also arose from some other things. So the court acknowledged all of what you're just talking about, acknowledged that it had imposed sanctions for that behavior, acknowledged that in the court's opinion, there was burdensome, overburdensome discovery on your part. And so then the issue before the court in the motion that's at, or in the order that's at issue here, was defendant's application for costs and also some from you. And as I understand the judge's order, which seemed really thoughtful and thorough, the judge went through every item and allowed some and disallowed some. And so I am trying to figure out, given abuse of discretion, how the judge who oversaw this lengthy litigation, contentious from what I can read, this is not the first time you've been to this court, how did the judge abuse the discretion given that background?
Your Honor, you have to look at the timeline. The limits on our discovery occurred long before the spoliation was disclosed and long before Mr. Kearney was retained.
And the judge in this order says that the judge dealt with that and sanctioned defendants for that behavior.
But, Your Honor, what you're mixing together is is the discovery as a whole and whether John Carney's bill, an expert witness, his bill, which was related exclusively to the spoliation issue, is somehow generalized to all discovery. It was not our discovery that caused John Carney to have to be retained. It was the spoliation of evidence, the deletion of text messages. The discovery that occurred after that was directly related to the same spoliation. What happened here, Your Honor, is that we see revealed in Mr. Carney's, in the documents we received from them, that they were talking to Mr. Carney about Lisa Stevenson Allen's reports that they claimed not to have completed, but that they were having conversations with Mr. Carney about and that had been completed that we still have never seen. Mr. Carney also refers to an affidavit that he prepared. He's even got it on his CV, on his website. And that affidavit was never disclosed, never used in this litigation. I don't know if it contained unfavorable information, but what this court is uniquely positioned to do is to say, look, if in an application post-trial you seek fees, you seek costs from the other side, and in that application...
Well, this isn't post-trial, it's post-motion for summary judgment.
Post-motion for summary judgment, I'm just referring to post-substantive case. You go and you ask for your costs and disbursements. But if in those costs and disbursements there's an invoice, there's information in that invoice that discloses that you failed to disclose a document, you failed to disclose an affidavit, you failed to disclose entire forensic reports, this court should be able to look at that information and weigh whether it is a reasonable and necessary cost, and it should disallow that cost. And if a district court says, I'm going to rubber stamp these costs just because they are in an application.
The court in this case did not rubber stamp the costs.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I disagree. I think if you read our brief and you look line by line through the costs that the court allowed, costs for motions that they lost, costs for witnesses they did not disclose, costs for affidavits that they did not ever disclose to us, surrounding a spoliation issue and a perjury issue that was admitted, the district court doing rough justice, that was not rough justice. That was an abuse of discretion. And I understand it's hard. It's difficult for a district court to really go through and line by line look at these expenses. But what a district court sometimes is left with is a lack of information. The district court did not lack information in this case. Our objection was pointed, specific, and in response, they were silent. And this court does not need to accept their silence as carrying a burden of proof. Here, they didn't carry the burden of proof. And if we are just going to award costs and disbursements in the state of Minnesota for efforts that were undertaken as it relates to spoliation, or to prepare expert affidavits that were never filed in the case and never disclosed, even though that is a line in an invoice, that's not rough justice. That is ignoring the burden of proof in this instance. Your Honors, I also want to deal with the nunk-pro-tunk order. So this is, again, a very unique situation in that in October of 2023, the court issued its order granting costs and disbursements. The court never entered judgment. We raised this issue by letter. We raised it repeatedly with court administration by letter. We said, you know, it's a mistake. You got it wrong. Please enter judgment. We want to appeal. The court administrator basically said, unless we hear from the Court of Appeals, we're not doing anything. So we made a petition for an extraordinary writ to this court. While that was pending, the district court entered its order. It entered an order nunc pro tunc, backdating its judgment to October of 2023. So 8 months of interest on an unappealable order is what the result was. Here, you can't do that. The respondents argue that you can. This is prejudice to any party that's on the wrong side of this issue. We brought this as a petition to this court, and then our petition was dismissed as moot after the district court entered its erroneous nunk-pro-tunk order. This court also has the opportunity with regard to that issue to clarify and make clear for court administrators everywhere, and I think this is something that really needs to be a roadmap for court administrators, because this is happening repeatedly in outstate Minnesota, and it's costing tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars to litigants in the state of Minnesota, where district court administrators don't understand they have to enter an order, but that judgment needs to be entered on that order in order for it to be appealable. There should not have been months and months of delay in this case that resulted from the entry of an erroneous nunk-pro-tunk order that resulted in prejudice to the Stevensons.
Well, help me understand your argument here. Maybe I'm missing something, but you're saying that order wasn't appealable because of the nunk-pro-tunk order. And I think the Duluth Ready Mix Concrete case suggests otherwise. Because it says, we hold that entry of judgment nunk-pro-tunk cannot operate to cut off a party's appeal rights.
That's true, but what happened here is the original order, no judgment had been entered, and as this court is well aware, you appeal from a judgment.
Right.
And so because that judgment had not been entered in October of 2023, we went into November, December, all the way through trying to get the court to enter that judgment. It never did. We finally petitioned for an extraordinary writ. While that was pending, the district court in, I believe, July said, I see you got an extraordinary writ on appeal. I'm going to enter judgment, but I'm going to backdate it to October of 2023.
But your appeal period, I mean, you could appeal at that point once that was entered.
We could, but we couldn't appeal in November or December, all of those months that interest is now accruing.
That helps clarify the argument.
And that's
Thank
the
you.
Prejudice.
But, so it's not that you couldn't appeal, it delayed the time.
No, we wouldn't have been able to appeal from that judgment.
Appeal once the nunk-pro-tunk order was...
That's correct, and that's what we did.
Okay, but I thought you were arguing you couldn't appeal at all.
No, we could appeal, but so only after judgment was entered. And in our view, judgment was entered in May of 2024, not in October of 2023. Okay. And once it had been entered, we were able to appeal.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the court. My name is Joseph Turan. I represent respondents along with co-counsel Ross Tenninger and Kristen Hansen. As we talked about, the timeline of this case obviously stems from the district court's grant of summary judgment and the subsequent granting of costs and disbursements. Respondents argue that the district court was acting within its discretion when it considered the 122 itemized costs and disbursements requested by respondents, totaling over $80,000. Appellants objected to several of these, and a hearing was held in September 2023. Following the hearing, the court issued its October 2023 order, in which it awarded a total of $60,757 of the original $80,747 in costs and disbursements. The court was acting within its discretion when it considered each line, accepting and denying several of respondents, and accepting in part even a few.
Counsel, it seems to me that appellant is arguing that they raised their objections. You, a respondent, did not respond in any meaningful way, and that lack of response demonstrates, or because of that lack of response, you did not carry your burden as it was your burden. Can you respond to that? Is it your burden? Did you carry your burden? And is a lack of response to their objections sufficient to carry a burden if you have it?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It's a great question. The burden here was a showing of these costs and disbursements. The district court considered each individually. The respondents were, again, as is mentioned by the panel during appellant's argument, handling an overburdensome discovery process, and there were multiple motions, a volume of motions and a frequency of motions that was rising to a level that, frankly, couldn't be withstood. Now, when the district court made these decisions, it went through each of these objected to and even unobjected to items. It carefully considered each, responding specifically to the Kearney Forensics motions and referencing that of this $18,677, it would award half. Now, something we need to focus on in that instance was there were three phones that were analyzed by Kearney Forensics. It wasn't just Sean Stevenson, who was found to have engaged in spoliation of evidence. There was two other phones. Neither of those respondents were found to have spoliated evidence, and the district court came to its conclusion that it couldn't bar all of the recovery from Kearney Forensics.
Counsel, appellant argues that Kearney was retained because of the spoliation and perjury, not to respond to additional discovery, and that it was necessary to look at these other phones because of the perjury that occurred. Can you respond to that argument? Because what you previously stated, I don't think gets to appellant's argument that the only reason Kearney was retained was because of the spoliation and perjury.
Yes, and Your Honor, the appellants did object to those costs because of the spoliation, but as the district court noted, some of the charges were in preparation of an affidavit that was actually part of the litigation. In preparation for litigation, this court has frequently held that in the instance of of a deposition, that even depositions not used can be awarded costs and disbursements when
party prevails. But it seems to me, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems to me they're saying it's almost like in the Fourth Amendment context, it's the fruit of the poison tree. And so I'm looking at page 9 of their response brief, and they quote from you saying, Lisa, in good faith, retained Kearney Forensics as her own expense to obtain a forensics examination of her phone in an attempt to recover spoliated messages. So it seems to me they're arguing that it was in response to Sean's perjury and spoliation that she obtained Kearney's report.
Yes, Your Honor. to address this, the reason Kearney Forensics was required was, again, it all stems back to the overburdensome discovery process and what was being discovered, the requirements placed upon the respondents. They were trying to recover as much information as possible. It wasn't solely based on this spoliation. And the district court took that into consideration when it, quote, uses rough justice to kind of split these costs to determine we won't award costs associated with Sean Stevenson's forensic analysis and focused on the remainder of Kearney's bill.
It seems like it's but for Sean's perjury and spoliation, she wouldn't have had to retain them. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't, Your Honor. Respondents argue that they had to retain the Kearney Forensics to to receive all of the associated, it's metadata associated with all of the text messages to help show, again, this is a lengthy proceeding that dealt with several motions and specifically that of what messages were sent to what family members at what time. So I think this getting forensic analysis on these phones was necessary as part of the preparation for trial. To move to the NUC pro tunc order that the district court moves to esponte. Again, appellants argue that this was abuse of discretion. Respondents argue that this is exactly what a NUC pro tunc order was designed for. This is to repair a clerical error, as the panel pointed out, in Duluth Ready Mix, an order which they denied a petition seeking determination of right to possess under eminent domain, and they held that the entry of the judgment, NUC pro tunc, cannot operate to cut off a party's appellate rights, where the date of the judgment of the appeal All right, so the fact that this NCRPA-TUNC order selected the date in which the October 2023 order specifically intended to be the enter of judgment, it corrected this clerical error in the exact process in which it was designed to do. Appellants, evidenced by our presence here today, are appealing this order, and their appellate rights were not denied by the district court's correction of this clerical error.
But if they were to prevail here, they would have many more months of interest to pay on that judgment.
Yes, and I understanding, Your Honor, that their argument that they are prejudiced by this added interest, respondents argue that they would be prejudiced if that interest was not added, because this is what the district court intended, was that the order be input in the October 2023 order, thus prejudicing the respondents and not receiving those months of interest associated with the judgment that was granted in the by the district court in the October 2023 order. In the court's order, the district court specifically noted that they're going to complete this cost and order disbursement in the amount previously discussed, $60,757, by creating it with a judgment and stamp NCRPA-TUNC October 13, 2023. We argue that the district court was operating within its discretion when it ordered the NCRPA-TUNC order, and as well as issuing its detailed analysis of which costs and disbursements to award to respondents and which to deny. With that, if there's any
questions. Yeah. I do have another question for you. I'm going back to Judge Harris's question about the burden, which I think is a very good one. Appellants argue in their brief at page 16 that the district court awarded fees that weren't incurred, or costs for fees that weren't incurred. And so did the district court err in that regard?
Yes, so I believe it was on, I'm not sure the page of the district court's order, but they considered several document, so they itemized each specific cost and disbursement with various letter designations with, I believe it was when they denied the motion previously reimbursed for C-17, and they withdrew for C-13, and for motion incurs, which shouldn't have been, that was C-6, C-20, 23, and 24. Here, the district court's order, it lists two of these orders that, or I'm sorry, two of these costs and disbursements that it would deny, two that it would allow, and then two that it would refund to respondents. I think the district court carefully considered each of these individual costs and disbursements and assessed which ones should be assigned and which should not be. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yeah, thank you.
Well, counsel, is that sufficient? It seems to me, because the court seemed to, in that section of analyzing the disbursements, kind of bunch a group of motions, C7, C12, C6, C20, C23, and C24, and they said, there's a couple of these that you're not entitled to, a couple of these that were paid and should be refunded, and a couple of these that you are entitled to. And rather than kind of tell us which ones are the ones, saying these you're not entitled to, the court merely said, we're gonna give you funds for two of them. Is that sufficient? Or it seems to me that area is a little bit confusing. Can you help clarify whether or not that's sufficient in the analysis?
The respondents argued that given the circumstances, the totality of the circumstances here, the district court, in this, would we like more specificity? Yes. We're working with, again, 122 line itemized costs and disbursements.
But earlier in the other line items, particularly motions, the court, and I agree, this was a very detailed order. They went through and they were like, this motion, you did this. I'm gonna give you cost for this, you know, and there's a whole bunch of motions they do that for, but then they come to this section where they just group the motions into this kind of bucket of miscellaneous, I guess I'd call it, and then they said, we're going to give you two of the six with really no more to grab onto, and I'm trying to understand, given the specificity in all other parts of this order, why would this be sufficient?
I think, Your Honor, that it wasn't two of the six. Although there were six referenced in that paragraph, it's going to be two of the four. So, again, that's still not the ideal situation, but it does narrow it down somewhat. Again, not pinning down exactly. Each of the motions were for a total of $80. Of these, that's $160 of the total $60,000. This error, should it be reversed and remanded to be corrected, the district court would undoubtedly come to the same conclusions that these are the only issues that I'll accept, deny, or refund to respondents. And I think that given the totality of the circumstance, that type of remedy wouldn't be necessary.
Can you briefly address the, I'm sorry, did that answer your question? The award for the IME, given that it doesn't appear that was used in the summary judgment motion, in support of the summary judgment motion, was that work cost for that properly awarded?
Yes, so for the Woodlake Medical Management,
yes,
that we were speaking of, Your Honor? Yes, so there was a fee for $6,880 for that independent medical examination. Appellants argue that it's unreasonable because it wasn't awarding costs. There's no provision in Minnesota. And your question, I'm sorry, can you rephrase?
Well, it wasn't used in support of the summary judgment motion, is that correct?
To my understanding, no, it wasn't used in the summary judgment motion, but the district court viewed all of these costs and disbursements as gathering of information due to the overburdensome discovery issues that had persisted throughout in preparation for trial. Not just that it was a summary judgment motion, but they had to prepare this medical examination beforehand. That burden was on respondents, and the district court determined that this was reasonable. It went on to cite sections 549.04 and 357.25 in making this decision, and we think the district court was acting within its discretion when it did so.
Thank you.
Yep.
Your Honors, I just want to address a few issues in rebuttal. First, the Carney forensics report was necessitated by spoliation. He was not retained at the beginning of discovery. He was not retained anywhere close to the beginning of discovery. We had motion practice and motions to compel before Mr. Carney was retained. He was retained behind the scenes to mitigate the spoliation that occurred and the perjury to cover up the spoliation. When he was retained, he then provided additional information about the spoliation and the discovery related to the spoliation. When someone says, I lied about deleting text messages from my phone in a deposition, there are a lot of other questions that raises. One of the reasons there was extensive discovery in this case is because, unlike many cases, this case involved spoliation of evidence and perjury. It also involved a claim relating to a conspiracy, meaning you have multiple people texting and calling each other to engage in the behavior that's alleged in the complaint. We needed to know when they spoke, what they spoke about, what they texted, what their scheme and plan was. That requires a lot of discovery. And when someone says, I deleted the evidence, you have additional questions. Mr. Carney, to be clear, was only retained as it relates to this spoliation. And as it relates to this affidavit, I just heard it referred to as a necessary affidavit. It was not obviously necessary enough to be submitted to the court or filed with the court, but Mr. Carney does indicate that he did prepare it. It's in his CV on his website. So It's something that was never used in this case, never provided to us, and it should not be compensated to Mr. Carney when he was only retained to address the spoliation issue. With regard to interest, they say, well, it's prejudicial to us if you don't enter interest. I don't understand the logic of that argument because we would have appealed much earlier had we been given the opportunity. If judgment had been entered in October, oral argument in this case would have occurred 8 months ago. It would not be occurring right now, over a year after this order was entered. And that in and of itself is prejudicial. What the law says in this realm is you can correct the clerical error, but you cannot supply judicial action, which is what entry of a judgment is. When you supply judicial action in a nunk-pro-tunk order, you commit error, and that's an abuse of discretion. I'd also note, Your Honor, with regard to your questions about the line items in the order, I believe the district court did include at the end of its order a series of line items. So we can actually track which ones the court entered and which ones the court did not enter. That makes it easier for us, and we've done this in our briefing, to say, look, they lost this motion, but the court granted that cost to them. Or they never incurred the cost, and the court still granted the cost to them. And so this court, it's going to be a little bit tedious, but this concept of rough justice, I mean, injustice is built into some of that rough justice. The lack of precision is not necessarily the ideal. The ideal court would be precise and get it right every single time. We understand that judges are taxed in terms of their workload and their time, but there are also times when the evidence reflects that a cost should not be incurred, it should not be transferred to the other side.
So, I also counsel, if on page 16 of your brief, you point to, I think, two motion fees that were taxed that you argue should not have been taxed. Those were $80 each. If this court were to agree with you, does that warrant reversal?
That warrants reversal by itself, but that is not
that. $160.
I would argue, Your Honor.
Case law out there that suggests that if it's a de minimis amount, that reversal is not required or necessarily appropriate, if that was the only error, assuming. And I'm not saying that that's what I would decide or this court would decide, but because we've made no decision, but just assuming that it was only a $160 error.
A $160 error would not have justified us bringing this appeal in the first place. We would not have done that over $160, but that is not what is at stake here. It is tens of thousands of dollars that's at stake in this appeal, and so it would not be de minimis. I would argue, too, Your Honor, that with regard to the medical, the IME, it was unfavorable to the respondents. They didn't use it at summary judgment. They didn't use it for obvious reasons. I see my time has expired. We ask the court to reverse and on both of the issues. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your argument. This matter has been submitted. We'll issue a written opinion within the statutory time frame. With that, that does conclude this morning's oral arguments, and court is dismissed. Thank you.
All rise.